Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about the cooking of India. And our guest for the program is Sunita Vaswani. She was born in Mumbai, one way or the other, in India, now makes her home in Houston, Texas, and has been living in the United States since the mid-70s. She has been teaching Indian cooking in the U.S. and internationally for 30 years, and she is the author of a couple of books. Her most recent is The Complete Book of Indian Cooking. It has 350 recipes, and the recipes are grouped according to the region. That is, there are recipes from the north, the south, the east, and the west. And there's great, great variety in here. And if you're interested in exploring the cooking of India, this would be a great resource. She also was the author of an earlier book. The title of that book is Easy Indian Cooking. And again, their recipes are organized here, designated by region within the chapters. And it might be that if you were not a very experienced cook, if you were kind of a beginner, you might want to start with the easy book. Or if you were very confident and you'd spent time in the kitchen, you could go right to the complete book of Indian cooking. And I'm sure that that would keep you busy and enjoying the various flavors here for a long time. She's joining us by telephone as we talk. Questions from people who are listening are welcome, certainly. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455, which either of those numbers works for you. Your calls at any point here are certainly welcome. Sunita Vaswani, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I'm just curious now, because I'm reading a little bit about you that said that in addition to having been involved in teaching Indian cooking, that when you came to the United States, you were also teaching traditional Japanese arts, the flower arranging, ikebana, and also the art of the miniature trees, bonsai and ikebana. How did you get interested in that?
Well, I was fortunate to have met a master of bonsai many, many years ago in the 60s. And I was fascinated because we lived in a big city and gardens were not the norm. We lived in high rises and had balconies. And I thought, what a wonderful way to be able to grow something and watch it, you know, develop artistically. So that was the reason for my interest in it.
And probably I would guess at that time in the 1970s that perhaps people, their experience with Indian cooking would have been more limited. Perhaps if they lived in a big city, they would have had the opportunity to go to an Indian restaurant, or perhaps they would know somebody who was familiar with that kind of cooking. But I would guess that for a lot of Americans, these flavors at that time would have been new.
You're absolutely correct, David. They were something that was too foreign for the American palate. And the early years, I would say the first 10 years, it was a struggle to get people to even try Indian food. And living in Houston, which is the fourth largest city in the United States, we had maybe two Indian restaurants, and they were frequented most often by Indian people and maybe a handful of non-Indians. And it was very, very difficult. But I was so sure that once people tasted home-cooked Indian food, it would be hooked, and I was correct. So I stuck it out the first 10 years and struggled with maybe sometimes no more than three or four students. Mm-hmm. Today my classes are full, and I'm happy to say people are excited and they know so much more about it.
And I'm sure also at the time it must have been difficult to get some of the most important ingredients that you would have needed.
Yes, that's correct, too. There was one Indian grocery store in Houston, and they did have almost everything we needed, but there were times every year when I went to India, I would bring back spices and a few other ingredients that were not easy to find. Today, there are, I believe, over 50 Indian stores just in the city I live in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not uncommon. I teach all over the country, and small towns have at least one Indian grocery store. And even small towns in Texas, where I'm invited to teach at cooking schools, people are very, very open to these new flavors. And so stores crop up where there is demand, and little restaurants pop up, and it's a growing industry.
Yeah. India is a, it almost goes without saying, India is a very big place. And there is a great deal of diversity in terms of culture and language and music and food, depending upon where you go. And I think that part of the reason of organizing the book as you have is to at least give people the appreciation that there are these very basic kinds of divisions, north, south, east, west. And we can talk a little bit about those things. But having said that, is there something, do you think, some sensibility, some technique, some flavor that in some ways transcends that, and that Indian cooking, no matter where you go, has people have something in common?
That's a very good question, David, and I have given it much thought in the past because it's cropped up before, but the truth is there really is, apart from the use of spices throughout the country, which is the common denominator, there is no one food or technique that binds every area. And that's where the diversity comes in, because so much of our food is also based on religion. People eat according to their religion. And to illustrate that, if I were to say that just as we have Jewish people in the United States, some people eat kosher, some do not keep kosher. And similarly, we have other people who, observe Lent and other such traditions. In India, we have those same sort of traditions multiplied by 100. So within the same religion, say Hindus, there will be a huge variety of eating patterns and habits. And similarly, we have the Muslims in India who do not eat pork, the Hindus who don't eat beef, others who don't eat anything that has the ability to create life, including eggs or cheese, because cheese is made with rennet. Those are the very, very, very conservative people, the Jains. So so much of our food is based on religion that it is very difficult to say that we have one unifying factor. The other difference is the northern half of the country is grain-based. Wheat is a major crop, and we eat a lot of other whole grains, sorghum and millet, for instance. So we have flatbreads made from many different types of flour made of these whole grains, and they are very different to what the south does, which is entirely a rice-based diet. The four southern states have that in common. They grow over 20 varieties of rice in the four southern states of Karnataka, where Bangalore is situated, Kerala, which is the spice coast of India, Tamil Nadu in the southeast, and just above that, the state of Andhra Pradesh, which grows the hottest chili peppers in the country. So those four states are entirely rice-based diets and have very little wheat. So those are the other differences between north and south.
It seems to me that one thing that you might say about the cooking of India is that it's probably, some people might want to argue, but it may well be the greatest vegetarian cuisine on the planet, I think. If people are interested in vegetarian food, or if they're just, you know, interested in perhaps eating a little bit less meat, and they're looking for things to do with vegetables, it could keep you busy for a long time just exploring different ways of cooking vegetables.
You're absolutely correct on that. And in addition to the varieties of vegetables we not only have, but the ways of cooking them, there is also the whole food group of beans and lentils. So the vegetarian, you're right, we have got the most wonderful variety of vegetarian food in India. And in fact, Julia Child once made a comment. She said, if ever I had to be a vegetarian, and she made it very clear that she would never be one, but if she had to, the only food that she would consider would be the vegetarian food of India because of its variety. So between the vegetables and the beans and lentils family, our vegetarian people eat extremely well. And I must admit that I'm very partial to that kind of cooking myself.
Just let me quickly introduce again our guest, Sunita Vaswani. She is the author of The Complete Book of Indian Cooking, 350 Recipes from the Regions of India, recently published by Robert Rose. She's also the author of an earlier book, which is titled Easy Indian Cooking. So if you're interested in trying to explore this cooking in your home kitchen, you might take a look at one or the other of these books. She was born in India, now makes her home in Houston, Texas, has actually for a number of decades. She's been teaching Indian cooking in the U.S. and internationally for 30 years and has been featured in many national magazines. She's been good enough to give us some of her time. And if you have questions or maybe you would like to call in and share some of your favorite thoughts about Indian cooking or if you have a recipe, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. This is something, again, certainly people are going to cook with different things from place to place, but probably another thing I think is true of Indian cooking is that in terms of mixtures of seasoning elements, it's one of the most complex, I think, that you're going to find just about anywhere. And people, I'm sure different cooks put these elements together in different sorts of ways. One thing I think probably here in the United States, probably in a lot of places, if you go into people's kitchens and you open up the cabinets where they keep their herbs and spices, you're going to find a bottle of something that's called curry powder that people will use in their cooking. And maybe for a lot of people, that kind of taste is what they're going to associate with Indian food. If you go to India and you go to your average kitchen and you open up the cabinet, are you going to find a bottle of curry powder?
No, David. No Indian kitchen has a curry powder. I call it the virtual curry powder. It was created for a specific purpose when the British were in India, and it served its purpose. And what it is a blend of anywhere from 6 to 15 or 18 spices that were assembled very quickly by the help that the English employed in their kitchens. And when they lived here for a couple of years, they were quite addicted to the flavor of Indian food, which included all these spices. When they went back on home leave, and we're talking of the 18th, 19th century, they would be gone for close to a year because it took three months to sail and there and back, and they spent a few months in England. And they missed the flavors of their food they had gotten accustomed to. And that's when the cook had gone into the kitchen, created a blend of the spices, and presented it to the lady of the house, saying that you can create a curry with this. Now, creating just one curry with that powder, which was perfectly authentic in its flavors, is fine. And they generally cooked a curry lunch on a Sunday afternoon, served it with all kinds of condiments, and that would be their big curry meal of the weekend. However, if you use that curry powder, assuming it's the world's best, and you cooked five dishes with that, you would have the same flavor in all your five dishes. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So the same spices used in different combinations and permutations would give you a multitude of different flavors. And it isn't necessary to have all the 10 or 15 spices in the same dish. Some are used all just one or maybe two spices. Some will use six, some will use three. And they're the same common spices. And if you have those, a spice rack of maybe 12 jars, you can cook 500 recipes from that.
You can in some cases you can also, if you go out and buy these spice elements, you can find them either already ground or a lot of these. I think most of these things we're talking about are seeds that are then ground into a powder. So you can generally buy them either way, already ground, or the whole seed. What do you get when you actually start with the whole seed, and as you want to use it, you just get enough of it and then grind that fresh right when you want to use it?
In concept, that is the way we like to eat. However, in practicality, it just adds extra time and work to a recipe. So the way most of us deal with it, and this is the way I've cooked all my life, is there are just two or three that need to be ground up after they are toasted. Coriander seeds is one, cumin seeds is another, which if you toast in a dry skillet for just 3 or 4 minutes at the most, and then grind them up in a little spice grinder and make maybe a 3-month supply, that'll last very, very well. What is not practical is if you have to do it every single time. However, if you are going to buy pre-ground, please buy a small jar, just enough for use in the next couple of months, because if you use the analogy of peppercorns or coffee beans, which we're all familiar with today, we don't anymore go out and buy a 1-pound can of ground black pepper. We all realize that when you fresh grind your pepper over your salad or in your soup or on your chicken, it's a completely different flavor. The aroma is fresh because you have just ground it up. So see, in the seed form, Indian spices last almost indefinitely. Once they are ground up, they become fragile spices because with exposure to air, they do oxidize. Mm-hmm. And each time you open that jar, air gets into it, and slowly the freshness and the aroma and the flavor are all lost. So this is the reason we do very small quantities of fresh roasted. And you can buy pre-ground small jars, you know, 2-ounce jars or 4-ounce jars. Just make sure that you use them up in the next 3 or 4 months, and then that's perfectly all right.
Mm-hmm. Cumin is, I think, one of my favorite spices. I think it's a wonderful flavor, and I was really very surprised the first time I did what you say, that is to buy whole cumin seed, dry toast it a little bit, just enough so that the aroma starts to come up off of it, and then put it in a spice grinder and grind it. It is different. It is different. It's hard to describe how it's different, but it's different from the ground cumin, even if that's good and fresh. There is something about it is different.
That is correct, but we do use it in more ways than one. Cumin seeds are used in 5 or 6 different ways in Indian cooking. And what you describe as toasting and grinding, what that does is, with exposure to heat, the essential oils in the seeds are released. That's when they become aromatic. So by toasting, you are already pre-cooking the cumin, and it becomes much more intense in its flavor. We do also use it ground up without toasting, and that's a different flavor. You're quite right. The other method very commonly used, especially when we are seasoning our beans and lentil dishes, is we will flash fry them. And what that is, a basic technique used in many, many dishes where you heat a tablespoon or two of oil, and when it's nice and hot, you throw in the seeds and they will pop and crackle, and within 30 to 40 seconds, you will get the aroma, the seeds turn a little bit darker, and they're cooked. And that is either tipped into the dish, or you continue by adding the next ingredients. So there are 4 or 5 different ways of using cumin, and each one of them has a different flavor profile.
There is a spice. We talked about the fact that if you go into a kitchen in India, that no self-respecting Indian cook is going to have curry powder. Mm-hmm. They will have the elements, perhaps, and they will use them in different combinations, in different ways, in different dishes. Now, there is one spice mixture that is frequently used in Indian cooking, and I'm thinking of the garam masala, What is the difference? And it has some of the same things in it that are in curry powder or that are in a lot of the recipes. What talk about garam masala and how it is that spice mixture came to be.
Garam masala is a very authentic North Indian blend. Garam means warm, and in this case we're talking warming for the body. Indian foods are based on the ancient Ayurvedic method of eating, where certain foods are warming and certain foods are cooling, and they don't necessarily mean that it's the food is like, for instance, watermelon you would consider to be cooling. Not in the old system. It was considered to be a food that you do not consider cooling. So there's no way of telling. You have to study the science to figure it out. But garam means warming for the body and consists of the whole aromatic spices such as cinnamon, cardamom, clove, the peppercorns, a fair amount of peppercorn, a little bit of cumin, a little bit of whole coriander seeds. And these are all ground. That's the basic recipe. All of this is ground up together and in specific proportions, and you get a mixture that is highly aromatic. And usually garam masala is sprinkled into a dish at the tail end of the cooking process. In other words, unlike coriander powder and cumin powder and cayenne and turmeric, we don't use it generally during the cooking process because it would lose its aroma and flavor. It's delicate. And it's usually when your dish is finished, you sprinkle it on and cover the pot and leave it for a couple of minutes so that the aromas infuse the dish. So it is a very authentic mixture and is used primarily in the north. The south hardly knows about garam masala except for small pockets where there is a North Indian influence. The south has a totally different blend that is ubiquitous to the south and used extensively. And that mixture is called sambar powder, S-A-M-B-A-R. And sambar powder consists of anywhere between 12 and 15 or 16 different spices. The most prominent one in that would probably be the fenugreek seeds, which is a bitter spice, has a lot of medicinal properties. And in fact, David, this might be a very good time to point out that Indian people use spices not just for flavor, but also for what each spice does for the body. As you said, you like cumin. Mm-hmm. The entire family of cumin, including anise and fennel and caraway, we use them all. That entire family is good for the digestive system. And turmeric, the yellow color in the non-existent curry powder, that is an antiseptic and a blood purifier. So there are all these multiple layers of understanding, and unlike what many people think, all Indian food is not hot. Spices are not hot. What is hot, what creates the heat, are the peppers, cayenne pepper, fresh green chili peppers, and of course peppercorns. And if you can't tolerate hot food, you just eliminate the peppers and you have perfectly wonderful, tasty Indian food without the heat.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. And before I do that, let me just very quickly, again, introduce our guest, Sunita Vaswani. She is the author of The Complete Book of Indian Cooking, 350 Recipes from the Regions of India. It's a paperback book. It's out fairly recently, published by Robert Rose. So if you're looking for a good book on Indian cooking, it has lots of recipes. And as I explained, they're organized within each section of the book according to the points of the compass, north, south, east, west, so you can explore the cooking that way. She's also the author of an earlier book, which is titled Easy Indian Cooking, and maybe you might want to take a look at that, too. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here, first in Moultrie County on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is a comment more than a question. I had the privilege of spending 3 months in India, as a 4-H representative of the United States, live with families. And one of the families I stayed with was, I would presume you would say, a very Orthodox Hindu family. And they were instructed to serve me an egg every day while I was there. I was there about 3 weeks. And I asked them when I got ready to leave, I said, what will you do with that plate? And the fellow that could speak English in the family said, well, we have no use for that plate. We'll destroy it when you leave because we do not eat eggs of any kind. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
Any way you could comment on that, Sunita?
Yes, I understand where that's coming from. It was, if I know the area where the caller was living, which part of the country, or the last
Gujarat.
Name.
Gujarat.
Gujarat. I would have guessed that. It's the Jains. The Jains are a very, very conservative religion. It's an offshoot of Hinduism originally, but the Jains are perhaps the most conservative of all the Indians. And they are the people who believe in not destroying any kind of living organism, including many of them will not eat anything, any vegetable grown underground, such as onions, garlic, carrots, because when you pull those vegetables up, you are going to destroy some of the little creatures that are in the soil and that surround these vegetables. That is how strict they are. So I totally understand, and since eggs have the ability to create life, they would not eat eggs at all.
Thank you.
All right. Did they somehow have the idea that because you were an American, you were used to eating eggs and you needed to have an egg? Or
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. The fellow that could speak English had been to the United States, and they felt like I needed the protein that I could get from an animal source of some kind.
Oh.
I'm sure that's the reason that they did that.
That's correct, because they realized that you would not probably eat the same amount of beans as they were eating, and that is the main source of protein for vegetarian people in India.
Well, the food that they had was wonderful.
Well, good. I'm glad that you enjoyed it, because that's, you know, real exposure when you live with a family. I'm so happy you did enjoy that.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the story. Let's talk next with someone else here in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
I have a little bit of a cold, so anyway, what is the influence of Indian cuisine on, let's say, Thailand and, let's say, Malaysia? These are two countries I've had food from. I know that part of the populations are Indian, so could you comment on that?
Most certainly. One of the most easy things to identify is the word curry. Curry is actually, it's not a combination of spices. It is a style of cooking. In other words, any dish which has a sauce, and we don't use the word sauce, we call it gravy. If you have a dish which has a gravy that has been created with the ingredients, it becomes a curry. And so the Thai curries are based on Indian. What they've done is take the specific spices and herbs that they put into each of their red or yellow or green curry, made a sort of a cohesive paste out of it, and that's how they become, you know, synonymous with Thai food. But the original style of cooking a curry came from India, so there is a major influence of Indian food on the Thais. And then, of course, they've taken their own ingredients, such as cilantro root, galangal. These are not ingredients we have, but they've taken the concept, infused it with their own additional herbs and spices, and that's how they have a very distinctive cuisine. Malaysia is the same way, and as you rightly say, because they have it has a fair number of Indian people or people of Indian origin, they have also got the influence from India. Both these countries tend to use coconut milk extensively in their cooking. And coconut milk is used, but only along our coastal areas in India, which, as you know, is a vast coastline that we have. The food of North India, which 90% of the restaurants in the North America are North Indian food. And if you notice, on their menus, there is a paucity of seafood because they had very little seafood available, and certainly hardly any coconut at all. And that's the characteristic of North Indian food.
And what finally, what about the influence on China? I know China, in terms of has...
Not really. We did not influence Chinese food, but a small minority of Indian people. These were immigrants from Iran or Persia that came in on, and arrived on the west coast of India in the 1300s because they were fleeing religious persecution. They were followers of Zoroaster, and they landed, and they have become Indian people. And it's a very small group. It's a dwindling number of people because they don't allow converts. They are known as the Parsis. And the Parsis had a very active trade with China. So some of the Parsi dishes have a little bit of Chinese influence, but the rest of the country, not at all.
Very informative. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, comments, stories are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There is an herb that I'm curious about that's in a number of these recipes. Just to confuse people, it's called curry leaf.
Uh-huh.
And which has nothing to do with curry, but and you say that it's the kind of thing where you really need to get the fresh leaves. I think, in fact, you say in the book, if you can't get them fresh, don't bother.
That's correct.
So I'm curious, though, about what sort of flavor curry leaves contribute.
You know, it's very difficult to describe the flavor. All I can say is it's extremely distinctive. It's a similar idea of trying to describe the Thai kaffir lime. It is so distinctive that there is no substitute for that. Similarly, the curry leaf, it's a tree that, as I'm speaking with you, looking at it outside my window, it has grown to 15 feet tall. It's a multiple leaf tree and has very inconsequential blooms. But when you take a sprig of curry leaves between your fingers and you crush it, you get the most amazing aroma. If you can't find it, and fortunately it is becoming more well-known throughout the country, and I get very excited if I can find fresh curry leaves in, say, Eugene, Oregon, and I have indeed found them. It's to me a sign of how this is becoming more widely known. So if you cannot find it, it's just ignore it. Because it's not a flavor that dries very well.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side is, if you find a few sprigs and they're sold in Indian markets in Ziploc bags, you get about 10 or 15 sprigs for very little money. You can put them in your refrigerator they will be fine for about 3 months. Because if they dry in your refrigerator, they still retain the aroma. So they're very usable. I have not tried to freeze them because there's been no need to do that. But dried in your own refrigerator, they are fine. Dried in the and bought, store-bought, they have no aroma.
Well, I'm going to have to make more of an effort in looking around. Perhaps someone who is listening can tell me if they actually are available here in Champaign-Urbana. I had not tried all the possible places where such a thing might be. So I guess I have to say I'm not sure whether I could, in fact, have gotten any fresh curry leaves here. I guess I assumed that I could not, but maybe that I shouldn't make that assumption, because we do have a number of very nice Asian groceries and places where you can get foods and components, cooking components, from all over the world. So I should definitely check.
Yes, you should. You might be surprised to find it, because in the southern part of the country, we're able to grow it outdoors year-round, and I have taken plants to California, Northern California and other parts, and it does very well there. But I did, in one of my classes, they were able to source them in Minneapolis. Now, admittedly, it was summertime, and they had no problem locating them in the Indian store, so it might be something worth looking into.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Ruth. I'm Anglo, but I grew up here in Urbana around a lot of Indians, so I'm very steeped in Indian culture. I wear suits all the time. And one thing I learned from my aunt Ajis is how to cook. And when I first learned, I learned to use a lot of tomato and a lot more spice. And now I have a lot of stomach ulcers, so I can't do that. So I use like more turmeric and ginger, which is better for your stomach. And it still tends to be the same curry, just with a different taste. And another thing I learned from my Anthony is you don't necessarily use cream. A lot of the North Indians, like, stores use a lot of cream. But we use, like, yogurt, which works very well. And another small thing is, as far as stores go, there are a lot of different stores like Euromart, World Harvest. Those are very good stores to find things. But a lot of the things there tend to be more Arabic. If you want to find more Indian things, there's an Indian store called Annapura, and it's over in the plaza where Pickles is. And I don't know if they have fresh curry leaf, but I know, I'm pretty sure they have dry curry leaf, and they have almost all the ingredients. They have pre-prepared food. They have tons of sweets, laddus, you know, coconuts and hair oil, and it's all Indian. And they also have a movie selection of Tamil and Hindi movies. So that's definitely something to give a try to. And just remembering the fact that, you know, even if you don't necessarily like the style of cooking that you get, you know, with North Indian, every single area of India, even within the states, is different. Like, Nagpur is different than Mumbai when you get a different curry. So that's what I have to say.
All right. Well, I appreciate all the comments. Well, in fact, Sunita, I think indeed you mentioned a little bit earlier that, say, you know, perhaps people have eaten in Indian restaurants here in the United States, that most of the Indian restaurants in America are offering Northern Indian style food, and that which is wheat based, which is not going to have a lot of seafood, and that if people are interested and they're willing to go into their own kitchen and try some of these recipes, that they will find that the tastes and the styles really are different, and they could take a look at some of the what's in your book, and they could try some Southern Indian recipes, for example, or Eastern or Western, and see how they are different.
That's very correct, David. But I just want to comment on one thing that the caller said about cream and yogurt. The truth is, in our home-style cooking, we don't use cream. The cream that is used in restaurant foods, and as I said earlier, 95% of them serve that one particular small, it's not that small a cuisine. It's called Mughal cuisine. The Mughals were the royal Muslim rulers of India for a couple of hundred years, and they introduced us to pureed nuts as a curry base. They introduced us to creams in their rich sauces and gravies. Saffron, these were all introduced by the Mughals. They lived a very rich life, they ate a very rich diet, and they built some of the most incredible buildings in the country, including the Taj Mahal. But the everyday Indian does not eat like that. Our daily food is extremely healthy. If you ignore the food group that is deep fried, and we certainly don't have to eat that every day, the normal food, the everyday cooking, is very healthy, very nutritionally balanced food. And my book has recipes both from a few of the restaurant favorites, obviously, but the emphasis is on the way we eat our daily diet. Yogurt, as the caller mentioned, is used extensively. We do some magical things with yogurt.
One of the things that seems that does seem to be true of a number of these recipes, at least a number of the, as I was looking at them, is that as a base, as an important sauce component for a lot of these recipes, there's a lot of onion.
Yes.
There's a lot of onion. And myself, I have a little trouble with onion. Is there any way to cut back or to substitute, or is that just not going to work?
Let me tell you something about onions.
Mm-hmm.
Onions have an enormous amount of moisture, and they also have a lot of inherent sugars. The way we cook our onions, and these, the ones you mentioned to form the gravy, the base, mm-hmm. Curry,
mm-hmm.
onions are used as a natural thickener. If you notice, we do not thicken our curries with a mixture of flour and water or flour and milk or anything like that. We use things like onions and tomatoes to be the natural thickening base of a curry. So, but the way we cook our onions is we cook them slowly and just for a very prolonged period of time, depending on what's being cooked, particularly if it's a meat dish. We cook them where they're almost burnt. By this time, 4 cups of onions is reduced to a mass which is about maybe a cup and a half. Because all the moisture, once the moisture is evaporated, you begin to caramelize the inherent sugars. That is what causes the browning of onions. And it requires this technique. As you brown them and as the sugars caramelize, the flavor is so intense that not only does it add a whole dimension of flavor to your gravy, but it also is a natural thickener. So yes, if you're not an onion fan, nobody will guess at the end of that you had 4 cups of onions to start out with.
I did. We now have knew that we were going to do this show for quite a while, and at one point I had really resolved to try to cook a number of recipes from the book, and didn't quite make my goal. Although I have to tell you that I did. I'd made the chicken curry in yogurt gravy,
uh-huh.
which I thought was very good, and I also made the Kerala chicken stew. And I know in months ahead, maybe this winter, I can get into some more things from the book. But I did make a couple of things out of the book, and I thought that it was good, and it was really different. I think than any of the other Indian recipes that I had tried, and I think it was they've been successful. But that was one. I guess that was one of the little thoughts that I had here and there as I was looking at a lot of these recipes was the amount of onion called for.
No, you are right, and the onions are used more extensively in North India and then in the south, but the amount of onions, because that is our main thickening, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
In the south, they use a lot of coconut milk. And so that gives them the thickening and the flavor, and we rely on the onions rather than the coconut milk.
Yeah.
When I say we, I'm considering myself a North Indian, because my family originally was from a state that has now become part of Pakistan. So we do not have a state anymore, but I consider our food from my ethnic background to be more North Indian. But it's totally devoid of cream and butter and all of that, much more the onion tomato-based foods. But I'm glad you had the opportunity and you made the effort to try the chicken stew from Kerala and the chicken curry. Both of them are from different regions, and I'm sure you noticed the difference.
Mm-hmm.
In the flavors.
Yes, and I just I do look forward to the opportunity to try some more of these recipes, because first of all, in cooking them, it made the house smell great.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that was wonderful, and I really did have the feeling that I tried it as best I could to follow your recipe, that I was getting something near the genuine item, or at least maybe what I would have if I really went into somebody's house who was Indian, something very close to what I would really get for somebody who had grown up eating and cooking that way.
Well, it sounds to me like it succeeded.
I think so. I thought the chicken curry and yogurt gravy was good, and it was even better a couple days later.
Yes.
it was much better a couple days later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think is kind of interesting, in your chicken recipes, use a particular cut that I had not used before. I think they almost all use skinless, bone-in chicken thighs, and that's not something that I had cooked with before. Is there something in particular about that cut that you particularly like?
Yes, and I'm so glad you asked that question, because I know people in North America prefer boneless, skinless chicken breast.
Yes.
That is the one cut that is so unsuitable for making a dish which is a curry. In other words, to braise chicken breast is a very bad idea because it cooks so quickly before it has time to absorb the flavors of the gravy in which it is simmering. And if you allow it to cook too long, as we all know, it becomes dry and flavorless and has absolutely no appeal to me.
Yep.
I reserve the chicken breast to use in stir-fry dishes, which we do have plenty of, or I grind them up in the processor and make chicken kebabs and other such foods, finger foods, or cut them up into chunks, marinate them, and grill them. So there are many uses for chicken breast in Indian food, but definitely not in a braised dish. When you use dark meat, whether it's chicken thighs or drumsticks, and they're interchangeable in most of my recipes, the bone in there, A, gives you a lot of flavor, keeps the meat very moist, and when you cook you braise the chicken as you should in its gravy, at the end of it, it is so tender, it just falls off the bone. You don't need a knife to cut that. We hardly ever use knives. With a fork, you can take that meat right off the bone, and you can tell the flavor is incredible. So please, I would encourage anyone who's going to use the chicken recipes, if they call for bone-in chicken, please try it. You will not be sorry.
Yeah, I would certainly say yes for people who had, if that's just, and I certainly in our house, we do use the skinless, boneless breast a lot. And for it's great for stir fries. It's great if you pound it out thin to quick saute that with a little sauce. That's a great thing. There's a lot of great things that you can do with them, but braising ain't one of them. And you really do need a different cut. And I was, I had not used these before, and that really worked very, very well. So I definitely think if it says use that, because it's going to make a big difference in what you're going to get out of it. Is there, we have just a couple of minutes left, and the problem with, I might have asked you to talk about something in particular. A little bit of the problem is that the ingredient lists on some of these recipes are quite long, and it's kind of hard to list that and expect people to get it. Is there something in the book, though, that you would say, look, if you're going to try one thing, make this?
Absolutely. In The Easy Indian, which was the first book, I would say, please try the pepper chicken. It has yogurt, cilantro, peppercorns, ginger, and garlic. And that's it. The end result is an amazing dish. I promise it is. You would not believe how you cooked it and what the end result is. That is a dish I have done time and time again in every class just to illustrate that point, that you do not need to use 15 spices. And what the yogurt does is, we cook a lot with yogurt, as I mentioned earlier, particularly in North India. Yogurt acts as a meat tenderizer when you combine it with ginger. So when you're braising your chicken in that mixture, what it does is infuse the chicken with an enormous amount of flavor, but tenderizes it, and it also keeps it moist. So topped off with crushed black peppercorn, which is flash fried for a minute, and a very healthy handful of chopped cilantro, and you're done. So definitely that is a must try. And in the second book, there are several recipes which call for one or two ingredients. I think there is one which is lamb with fennel and nigella. Now, I understand nigella is not a very common a spice, and you probably cannot find it in a regular store. But if you happen to live near a Middle Eastern store or have access, to anything on the internet, these are just two seeds, that you flash fry, and you braise or you simmer your meat, chunks of meat, in pureed onion, ginger, and garlic until there's no moisture left. By this time, and there's a lot of vinegar in that. Again, the acidic value of vinegar and ginger tenderize the meat. And there is no liquid left. At that point, you brown it lightly in the pan. and you flash fry your nigella seed and the fennel seeds, and you top that, mix it, and you're done. Seeds have an enormous power to flavor dishes, and you don't need to spend a lot of time sauteing anything. So there are other examples of this sort of cooking in the book, and it's not that every dish takes you 20 minutes and 20 spices.
Well, and I don't want to discourage anybody or scare them off from the book, because it's not that these recipes, I think, are difficult, but if depending on how much experience you have in the kitchen, you might find it a little daunting, so it's possible that you might want to go try the Easy Indian Cooking Book first, perhaps. Look at some of those recipes. And then if you're a very confident cook, you might also look at the Complete Book of Indian Cooking, both by our guest Sunita Vaswani, this book is published by Robert Rose. The other book, is that the same publisher?
Yes, same publisher.
All right. Our guest Sunita Vaswani, she was born in India, she now, and has for a number of years now made her home in Houston, Texas, and has been teaching Indian cooking in the United States and internationally now for 30 years. And we want to thank you very much for spending some time with us. I've certainly enjoyed talking with you, and I will spend some more time with this winter, I promise. I'm going to make some more recipes out of your book.
Wonderful, and thank you so much, David, for having me on your show.
Thanks, sir.